Okay, so this is it. We're on there. Okay. Somebody else going?
Yeah. I think more guys are gonna come.
Okay. Okay. The muscle's there.
Okay. I was wondering if you mind recording this.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been recorded.
Okay. So I guess everybody's here. Okay. So tonight we're going to be discussing the Pooh Parsia. All right. Now, before I start, I would just like to give a short introduction. Okay. What the idea of a proof is. All right. Because really, we have two kinds of knowledge. Man can have two kinds of knowledge. One kind of knowledge a person can have is theoretical knowledge. Okay, that's like knowledge of Gemara, knowledge of math. Okay, the second type of knowledge a person can have is practical knowledge. Practical knowledge, an example of practical knowledge, is the knowledge that we get from our senses. Okay, from our five senses. Now, the proof of our Sinai really deals with that kind of knowledge, practical knowledge. And the principle, really, they have to keep in mind with practical knowledge is really the idea of consistency. In other words, if a person accepts the five senses, accepts what his senses tell him, then if he wants to be consistent, he has to accept that straight through. He can't at some point, for convenience, say, well, we don't really know the senses, we don't really know anything. You see, that would be inconsistent. So, what we require with the knowledge, the practical knowledge, is that a person be consistent. Okay. All right. Okay. So, let's just start now. The proof of our Sinai deals with that kind of knowledge, practical knowledge. Okay. Yes.
What type of consistency are you talking about? Because, like, when a person looks at the railroad tracks and sees that they meet in the distance. Then if he completely wanted to be consistent in trusting everything his senses told him...
No, I'm not talking about that kind of consistency. I'm saying if a person will get into a philosophic debate and say, well, we don't really know anything about the senses, so therefore I don't have to accept... We don't really know that the senses are right, so I don't have to accept anything you say. Even though in his practical life, he guides his life based on the senses, but when it comes to philosophical argument, he says, well, I'm not going to accept those results because we don't really know anything. We don't know if the senses are really true. If the person will maintain that, then he has to apply that to all parts of his life. But you can't be selectively practical. That's inconsistent. So that's the type of consistency I'm speaking about. Okay? So... Now, okay, so let's, with that in mind, let's talk about the proof of our Sinai. Okay? Now, what we're trying to prove here is that the events at Har Sinai, the events depicted in the Torah, in fact occur. Okay? That's what we're trying to prove. Now, very often, when you're studying a particular, when you're trying to gain knowledge of a particular, sometimes, in order to gain knowledge of a particular, you have to have knowledge of the general. Like, I'll give you an example. If I want to study how a light bulb works, well, I have to know that a light bulb is a particular application of the principle of electricity. So if I don't know anything about electricity, my chances of understanding the particular of a light bulb are very slim. Okay? So in order to understand a particular of an area, very often we first have to have general knowledge, generic knowledge. Okay, so I think the same thing applies over here. What we're asking is, how do I know that this particular event at Sinai occurred? I think instead we have to translate the question into a more generic term. Okay, so how would you take that question and transform it into a more general question? How do we know anything? Okay, good. That might be too general. So let's, but it's, that's...
How
that's,
do we know anything in the past event?
Okay, how do we know anything that we ourselves did not observe? How do we know anything that we ourselves did not observe, that somebody else observed? Okay, I know that George Washington existed. How do I know that? I did not observe it. Okay, I know that World War II happened. How do I know? I did not observe it. Somebody else observed it. Okay? So the point is that in knowledge, there are really two categories of knowledge. There are things that I observe and things that somebody else observed. Okay? And he conveys that information to me. So things that, and every bit of knowledge that we have really comes from one of those two sources. Either I observed it or somebody else observed it. So really things that I observed we'll call first-hand knowledge, and things that another person observed we'll say that is second-hand knowledge. It's knowledge that I acquired through the observation of another person. Okay? Now any knowledge that we have is either first-hand or second-hand. Okay? The question is, what would you say most of our knowledge, would you say it is first-hand knowledge or second-hand knowledge?
Second-hand
knowledge, right? Because the amount of first-hand knowledge we have is really very small. I mean, when you think of it, the vast majority of everything that we know comes from second-hand knowledge. If a person studies science, physics, for example, well, if he reads a physics book and he reads all the experiments that were done, unless he is going to duplicate and repeat all of those experiments, he's relying on the veracity of second-hand knowledge. He believes the author. Okay, he simply believes what the man says. The man said he did an experiment, I believe him. Okay, I'm going to rely on second-hand knowledge. If a person gets onto an airplane, he does not know that the man sitting behind the cockpit is a pilot. He never saw the guy before in his life. So he believes him when the man says, I am a pilot. That is second-hand knowledge. When a person takes an aspirin, unless the man was in the factory when they mixed together the chemicals and he kept track of that particular pill, then he is relying on the label that states that this is aspirin. That is second-hand knowledge. It's something that he had no direct observation of. Okay? A person goes to a doctor, a person goes to a hospital. He doesn't know that's a hospital. He is relying on the say-so of other people. Okay? So if a person rejects second-hand knowledge, he simply would not be able to exist for more than maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Okay? He simply could not exist. Because practically 99% of the things that we do rely upon the fact that we believe other people. Okay? So that's a point that you have to be clear about. Okay? If a person thinks that he can rely on his own senses, first-hand knowledge, and get by in life, it's an absolute, he's fooling himself. It's an absolute impossibility. Okay? Okay. But that's very good, except for one fact. We don't believe everything that people tell us. If a man comes to me and tells me he has a great investment and I should deposit a large sum of money in a certain bank account, I don't think that we're going to be too hasty to believe, even though it is secondhand knowledge. I don't think that we're going to really jump at that opportunity, right? So the problem is that secondhand knowledge is very nice, but what secondhand knowledge do we accept? And what do we reject? We have to have some way of differentiating between what is reliable knowledge and what is unreliable. Okay? Now, the question is, how do we do that? And we have to do it, right? It is not an option. We can't say, we are using some formula. Every day of our lives, we must be using a formula because it's impossible to exist one day without it. So there must be some formula that we are employing subconsciously in which we have a way of differentiating between reliable secondhand knowledge, believable knowledge that we accept, and knowledge we reject. And the question is, if we could discover that formula, well, then we could take that formula and we can apply it to our particular case. And then we can see if our particular case warrants our acceptance or rejection. Okay? Okay. So how do we discover this formula? Okay, so I say what we have to do is we have to take a case. I have to take a case and see how we react to this case. Okay, a man comes up to me and tells me a story, makes a statement, or any kind, tells me a fact. Okay, when that happens, what do I do? What goes on inside of my brain? I hear what the man said, the statement that he made, and there appears before me two possibilities in my mind. One possibility is that the statement that the man made is true. That's one possibility, okay? But there's another possibility that appears, an equal possibility that appears before my mind, and that is that the statement that the man made is false. that these are the only two possibilities that could occur to a person. Okay? And the question is, how do I differentiate? Okay? So let's take the first statement, the first possibility. Okay? The statement is true. Well, how can I know that? That's the whole problem. I don't know whether the man is telling me the truth. So let's forget about that for a second. Okay? But we do know one thing. We know that the statement that he made must, of necessity, be either true or false. There are only two possibilities. Okay? So if I could eliminate any possibility of falsehood, then I would have a reliable method of ascertaining truth. In other words, if I could identify every possible cause, every reason why a statement would be false, and I could eliminate every one of those reasons, then I know logically that statement must be true. Okay? So I say this is the method that we have to use in order to analyze and assess a person's statement. Okay? So let's take a look. What would you say are the possible causes, the possible reasons for a statement being false? A man makes a statement to me, okay? Let's assume the statement is false. A man says whatever he says, okay? I assume that statement is false. What are the possible reasons why that statement would be false?
He's lying.
Okay, one reason is the man is lying. He has some motive to lie. And he has fabricated a falsehood intentionally, and that's why the statement is false, because the man's lying. Okay. Are there any other possibilities why a statement would be false?
He doesn't understand what he saw.
Okay.
He doesn't understand what he said.
The man doesn't know. He's not intentionally telling me a falsehood, but he simply lacks the knowledge. He is ignorant. He thinks he's telling me the truth. In fact, the man is telling me something false. Okay? So the two possibilities we have so far is either the man is intentionally falsifying or the man is unintentionally falsifying and he's doing that because of ignorance. Could there be any other possible ways that a statement would be false other than those two methods? Yeah.
You have other facts that contradict this argument that he's making?
Other facts that contradict it. Okay. And he is ignorant of those facts or he knows those facts?
I mean, would it matter what his motives are? Like if you perceive something as true, an object will be true, no matter what his intention is.
Well, I just want to know, because from his standpoint, right, we want to know what caused him to make a false statement. Okay, so if there's information that contradicts what he said, right, either he knows that information, in which case he's intentionally trying to find it, or he's blind to that information, he doesn't know it, in which case he's trying to be honest, but unfortunately he's ignorant of the possibilities that contradict what he said. Okay? So again, that would fall into one of the two categories. Right? But really, when you think about it, there can't be any other possibility. Because when a man tells something, does an action, it's either intentional or unintentional. There's just no other possibilities. If it's intentional, it means he's lying. If it's unintentional, then it means he simply doesn't know. Okay? So really, we have isolated in a false statement that there are only two possible causes, two possible reasons. Now our task is a little easier because now that we have isolated the only two possibilities, now if we could exclude each one of those possibilities in any given case, then we will know beyond the shadow of a doubt this statement must be true. Okay? So the question is, how can we eliminate, let's take the first possibility, that the statement, the man is lying. How do we eliminate the possibility of a lie? How can we do that?
Determine that he has no reason to lie.
Okay, we could determine he has no reason to lie, right? We could, in fact, give him a lie detector test, right? Or if we had enough knowledge of psychology, we could look into his psyche, and we could see this man has no motive to lie. You see? Okay, that would be a method. That would require, of course, a particularized case. In certain cases, I might be able to find out the man has no motive. I might be able to give him a lie detector test. But it would not be practical in a generic sense. Right? It would depend on the conditions and your relationship with him. If you were close enough to him and you saw, hey, that guy's definitely not lying, fine. But if the man was a total stranger and you had no way of subjecting him to any kind of test, you would, again, be left in the dark. Okay.
If you could verify yourself, if you already knew that some of what he said was true.
That's right. Then you would know the man's telling the truth.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, but then you would know based on what kind of knowledge? First-hand knowledge or second-hand knowledge?
Second-hand knowledge.
No, well, if you knew already the fact beforehand, so then you knew it was true first-hand. Now, when he said it, right, then you wouldn't be relying on his statement. You'd know it yourself, right? If there was something that he added to that that I didn't know myself, so then again, I would have to see, 1 second, maybe the man is ignorant and maybe he's still fooling me with regard to that detail. Okay? Okay. So what you're saying is correct, but what you're saying demands specialized knowledge and a special type of way of determining. Okay? But I want to say that there is a method that we could use that we can apply universally, where I can apply to a person I know as well as a perfect stranger. Okay? And the way that we could tell, we could differentiate and find out a lie is by numbers. Through numbers. Okay? I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, I'm walking down the street and a person rushes up to me, a person I don't know, a stranger, rushes up to me and tells me 2 blocks away a man was just shot. Oh, okay. I hear this story and I may be really in disbelief. I may feel the guy, you know, who knows who this guy is? A crazy guy, he's trying to fool me. I don't know whether the man is telling the truth. Okay. A few moments later, I see dozens of people, perhaps 100 people, come rushing from that scene, and they all are screaming that a man was shot, a man was shot. Okay. Would I be more inclined to believe the story? The answer is, a person would be more inclined. You would be more inclined to believe something that he heard from 100 people that was verified by 100 witnesses than just one individual. Okay? Now, why is this? Why has a person become more inclined to believe something the larger the number of people are testifying? Okay? For one simple reason. Because when an individual tells me something, there is the possibility of a lie. When a mass of people tell me something, then we'd have to be saying there's a mass conspiracy. Okay? And a mass conspiracy we reject. We do not accept the possibility that mankind in general, that his nature is that he gets together to fool me. We say one individual, yes, he may be an exception. He may be somebody that has some kind of motive, he wants to fool me. But mankind in general, no. That we say is absurd.
Why?
What's that?
Why is that absurd?
That's an absurdity because we would have to assume that it's man's nature to lie. That he by nature is a deceptive person. That we say is absurd. You see, we say that mankind in general is honest. And a person that lies, we always find some kind of exception there. Why is the man lying? You see, let's say a person lies. You say, hey, why do you lie? Why do you ask that? You ask that because that's an unusual thing. A person in the normal, the rule is, a person doesn't walk around lying. If the rule was that people lie, then when you heard a person tell the truth, you'd say, hey, why do you tell the truth? You see, that shows that the nature of man, the rule is, people tell the truth. That's the natural behavior of man. A lie is something that occurs because of an exceptional situation. You see? That's why, for instance, could anybody come along and say, make a claim, George Washington never existed? A person could do that, but he'd expose himself to tremendous ridicule. Why? Why would people immediately reject that? Because they would say, well, if George Washington never existed, well, what does that mean? That means that there is a whole generation, an entire nation, that got together to make up a story and fool people, and just fool the next generation. That's an absurd idea. That's simply an absurd idea. A person does not accept such an idea. You see, so the idea of numbers is how we in our lives, that's exactly how we in our everyday lives exclude the possibility of a lie. That's how we do it. And that's why when we go to a doctor, well, we say, I mean, there's a whole institution of medicine. There are many people that are around this person. If he's not a doctor, how could he be in this office? How could he have that diploma? You see, it is based on numbers. That's all it's based on. It's based on the premise that man's nature is not to amass fool people. That's not what man does. A person that fabricates a lie is an exception. You see? So that's really the basis that we're able to reject a lie. Okay.
Why can't you just have a bunch of exceptions?
You could. But I say again, see, that's why I introduced the proof with the idea, what kind of knowledge is this? You're asking me a question, you're asking me a question about theoretical knowledge. But the proof is not theoretical knowledge. Could I prove theoretically that it's impossible to have a million people? What are the probabilities that a million people somehow got together and told a lie? Could I show it's impossible? No, that's a theoretical question. What I said in the beginning is that this proof belongs to the category of knowledge, of practical knowledge. Now, if you're asking me in a practical sense, why can't it be that everybody's lying? I say, fine, if you accept that, it's absurd to us. But if you accept that, you have to be consistent. So next time you get sick, don't dare go to a doctor, because how do you know? How do you know it's a hospital? How can you get on a plane and fly? You don't know the pilot from anything. You see? So it's practical knowledge that we're dealing with here. If a person is consistent, then he has to be consistent all around. Okay, yeah.
How about kohagam kose? Is that not with a lot of people? Is that just individually?
Okay, so that's a separate question. You're asking, right, since we know that this is true, right, the question is, how could David Melech say that everybody's a liar? I mean, it seems to contradict everything we know. People are liars. You see? Okay, so we'll have to take that up. Okay, but really right now, I want to focus on the idea of the proof. Okay? So, if we'll take that statement literally, that every person is a liar, then you understand yourself. You can't take an aspirin, because all the people in the factories are liars. How could I rely on this label? Okay. So that statement is not literal, or it has to be subject to interpretation. Okay. Okay. So that's how really, if you ask me theoretically, should we do it? Who knows? But if you're asking me practically, is this the method we employ to exclude a lie? That is for sure. Numbers is the method that we exclude. Yes?
Because then any single case, meaning there's no reason to say that this case is the exception over any other case. Then
that's
by
right.
Every case you have to make
so like, every case
is exception.
That's right. In other words, when they made the aspirin in the factory, all the workers are exceptional workers. They're all liars. You see? So I can't rely on anything. Then verification becomes impossible in any case. Okay? Okay, so that's... Yeah.
I could see in general rejecting a mass conspiracy because of the unlikelihood that a mass amount of people would share a common motive. But in a case where it does seem likely that everyone's sharing a motive, like if you had a the case you're saying with the insurance thing, like the person coming up and selling you something, if a bunch of people came up to you and said the same thing, then it was in a fashion that it seemed like they're coming from a sketchy company or something like that. Then no matter how many people came up to you, then if you suspected that each one of them had the same motive, then you'd assume that they're all lying to you, right?
You can't know a person's motive. You see, you can't know a motive. I'll ask you, did George Washington exist? I'll say, well, how could a whole generation of people fabricate this? Well, they all had the same motive. What is that motive? I don't know. I wasn't there. You see, if you're going to go into motives that we'll accept, that we're only going to accept numbers when we can exclude a motive, how can you exclude a motive? I mean, people at the factory that are making aspirin, maybe they have a crazy motive. I don't know them from Adam. How can I start speculating on whether a person has a motive to be a crazy guy, a pilot, who's not really a pilot. I have no way of doing that.
So when the single salesman comes up to you, and he says his thing, and you suspect that he's just trying to take advantage of you, then there you're guessing his motive, and it seems
in which case are you talking about?
A case where a salesman is coming up to you and trying to sell something ridiculous to you.
Right.
Then in that case, then you can usually, then it's usually pretty clear what his motive is, or that this guy has a motive.
That's right.
So what's the difference between being able to perceive the single guy's motive? Versus doing it on a mass level.
You're saying that if 1,000 people try to trick me, and there's no honest person there,
if you can tell if there are cases where you can tell that one person is tricking you,
is he telling me something? Let's not get confused. Telling me that's not necessarily a lie. If a salesman tries to sell me a stock, that's not what we're talking about. We are talking about a lie. A person comes along and makes up a fact. You see, a person that tries to sell me a stock, he believes the stock is going to be good. Now, he may be under the influence of various emotions. He wants to sell me the stock, you see, but he's not telling me a lie. The man is not lying to me. A lie means when a person makes up a total fabrication, comes along, he wants to sell me something that doesn't exist. Okay? You may have one or two guys that are going to do that. That is not... does not exist on a mass level.
But in those cases, then even though there aren't that many cases like that, then you can accurately perceive the person's motive, right?
Okay. If what? In which case?
In the case where a person's trying to sell you something that doesn't exist.
Right.
So you can perceive his motive, right?
Right.
So what's the difference between that case where you can perceive the guy's motive? And versus the cases that you're saying that when it's on a mass level, then how can you possibly perceive their motive? Like it seems like there are cases where you can clearly perceive a person's motive, even if there are not, even if there aren't that many cases, and then there are cases where it's impossible to. So what's the difference between?
I don't know. Somebody else.
Anyone else?
I think the problem is because I think you're saying that in the case with just one person, you're saying that you are saying that his motive is that he wants to, rip me off or whatever. But in the case of the mass scale, how come you can't also perceive their motive? I think the problem is, though, it's not that you're saying this is his motive. It's just you can't verify it as being true, so you're not going to invest in it.
That's right.
Like, I'm not saying that you're lying. It's very possible that you're right and I'm going to make $1 million, but it'd be ridiculous for me to believe that. However, if you get a million people that are all telling me that they're making $1 million off of it,
right.
Then you're like, okay, everybody can't be lying, or else
right, exactly.
Any single case, everybody could be lying. And the truth is, with money, you could say, doctors, that they just came up with this great idea to make tons of money,
right.
And they don't know what they're talking about.
Right.
They just say, okay,
they give me a crazy thing, and then it doesn't work, and it's just total fabrication. So why don't we have that? We don't have that because a person cannot do that. The nature of a person is, he has a certain honesty. If a person's a doctor, you're not going to find 10,000 doctors. They're just all dishonest. And then you're saying the man in general is dishonest. That simply we can't rely on a person's sense of honesty in general. If that's the case, then how can we rely on anything?
Hey, hold on. What exactly are you saying is going on when you do know that a person is lying to you? You're saying it's not that you really know that they're lying?
You don't know that they're lying. You just can't verify that they're telling you the truth, and therefore I'm not going to invest money in this. But if it's something, let's say somebody came over to you and said, here, take this card and you'll make $1 million. You don't have to invest anything into it. You just take the card.
Isn't what we were saying before about not knowing if something is true? We were saying the reason why we don't know if something is true is because we suspect that there could be reasons that it's false. Right? Isn't that what we're grounded?
Okay, let's just hold the question, okay? And then I'll take it after. Yeah.
So that's all great that a crowd is not going to have a fabricated lie. That's great. But a crowd certainly can have a lie that they don't know about. Like, they can misunderstand something. And certainly, they're lying, but they're not trying to. And you'll be fooled by numbers because they're not trying to lie to you.
That's correct. So then, you see,
that's ignorance.
Then we have to get to the second
category.
Right. Because lying is... We're using the term lying, not that the man is necessarily telling me something false, but it's an intentional deception. Okay, we're using it as an intentional deception. If he doesn't know that he's lying, so that we're going to get to. Okay,
so
that numbers will not help you. Ignorance, you could have a million ignorant people, it's not going to help. Numbers will not help over there.
Because you can definitely have someone, this would be a smart person, If he wanted to tell a lie,
right.
what he would do is he would make a crowd of people misunderstand him.
That's right. That's
so that
right.
they would
exactly.
tell other people.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. But then there would only the lie would only have one person. Okay. It would just be propagated by many, but they are doing it through ignorance. Okay. So we have to get to ignorance. Right. But you're right that if a person may be telling something that's false out of ignorance, and it may have originated in a lie. Okay.
Can you know some of why numbers precludes the possibility of it being a fabrication? If we're willing to accept the possibility that one person would create a fabrication, then why? Just because there's numbers?
Okay, so then I say, what I'm saying is the idea of a mass conspiracy we reject. Why do we reject it? Generally, we reject it because we maintain that man in general is honest. People do not congregate for the purpose of just deceiving others. Okay? Now, that's something that we just sense, okay, that if you have a million people standing around and you tell me there's not one honest person there, we sense that that's not realistic, okay? But again, I can't answer you in a theoretical sense. If a person will insist, no, I maintain that people are dishonest by nature, and therefore it is very easy to get together millions of people and they'll just lie like nothing, no problem. If you maintain that, I have no problem with it. The only thing is we have to say that you have to be consistent, okay? And if people can do that, so then the next time you're on Delta Airlines, that's a company, a large company with, I don't know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees, and you can assume that they're all lying and that the man in the cockpit doesn't know what he's doing. And why would you get on that plane? I don't know. But if you're going to maintain that thesis, you can do so. There's nothing wrong with it, but you just have to be consistent, okay? But if you're going to have a feeling, well, this is JetBlue, this is a big corporation, I mean, there's thousands of people here, they can't all be lying to me. Well, then that's what you're saying. You are saying that numbers excludes the possibility of a lie. There's got to be some honest people there, and these people are going to blow the whistle, and people can't get away with it. That's what you're saying. Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, like, over time, you're asking, like, all the big conspiracies that come out, like Enron and all these big scandals. Like, the one thing that always bothers me that seems to still ring true, even though we are so convicted that it's not,
yes,
are these false religions.
Okay.
They're huge.
Okay. So we have to get to that, false religions. Okay. But let's finish first the formula, and then we can see from that formula, you see, whether our religion conforms to the formula, and we should believe in it, and why the other religions, whether they conform to that formula. And if not, why people believe in it. In other words, if they conform to that formula that we arrive at, we should believe in it. And if it doesn't, why does anybody believe in it? That's your question. So now we have to just get to the point where we have the formula in our hands, then we can apply it and see the answer to those questions. Okay? Okay. Okay, so the first element that we arrived at is that one way a statement could be false is due to a lie. And the way we can eliminate a lie is through numbers. Okay? So that's the first step that we can use to eliminate that cause of a falsehood. Okay? Now, there's only one cause of falsehood left. It's either a lie or the man is ignorant. That is the only other cause of falsehood. So if we have a method of eliminating ignorance, so then we have a viable method that we can use to determine whether a statement is true or false. Okay? Now, how would you eliminate the possibility, how would you eliminate the idea of ignorance? That a statement is false because of the ignorance of the person telling the statement. How would you exclude that possibility? Yeah.
If it were, I would say that I would believe him.
Yes.
If it were something that I could, if I were in the same position, I would be able to say the same thing.
Okay. So I'll give you an example. Okay. Let's say you have a person that's a nuclear physicist. And you ask the man, how many electrons does an oxygen atom have, right? And he tells you the answer. Okay, now assuming he's not lying, let's just isolate ignorance, okay? Assuming he's not lying, and he tells you the answer, but you yourself have no knowledge of chemistry, so you don't know the answer, okay? So you would not be able to answer that question. Would you believe the physicist that he has the expertise to give you the answer to that question? Well, I'll ask you. Let's say you're sick and you don't know how to treat the illness. Would you go to your next door neighbor who has no knowledge of medicine, or would you go to a doctor? The doctor. And whatever the doctor told you, no matter how ridiculous it would sound to you, you would do it in a second. Because you know that he is the man with the knowledge. Okay? So therefore, how do we exclude the possibility of ignorance? We exclude the possibility of ignorance if we can determine that the fact that we are looking at, that statement, is within the range of the intelligence or the expertise of the observer. In other words, if a man comes in from outside and tells me, do you know that it's raining outside? Well, that is not a statement that I would say, well, perhaps he's ignorant. Perhaps that observation is not within the realm of his ability to observe. Not true. That's a simple observation, and any man can make that observation. So I would conclude he definitely cannot be ignorant. If that statement is false, it cannot be because of ignorance. Okay? Conversely, if the man came in and told me how many electrons are in an oxygen atom, and he has no knowledge whatsoever of chemistry, I think I would be a little bit questioning. I might be doubtful. I would certainly double-check that answer. Why? But not because I think the man is lying, but because I would say that knowledge is beyond the scope of his expertise. Okay? But if a nuclear physicist told me the same information, I would have perfect confidence that the man, that statement is 100% true. Okay? So the way we can eliminate falsehood due to ignorance is by an evaluation of the expertise of the observer. If the fact that he's reporting is well within the range of his expertise, then I have to say that the statement cannot be false due to ignorance. Okay? If it is out of the range of his expertise, well, then I certainly cannot exclude ignorance. Okay. So the only way that we can ascertain ignorance or non-ignorance is by by knowing the expertise of the person and the complexity of the fact. A very simple fact, anybody could know it. A more complex fact, only a few people can know it. Okay?
Something can be a simple fact and you could still make a mistake about it. Like, it's within the realm of your knowledge. Like, if I tell you that it's raining outside, you'll say, well, it's easy to tell that it's raining, but it could be when looking outside I made a mistake. Would you say it's not within the realm of my knowledge? Mm-hmm.
Well, then what you're saying is we can't trust our senses. Then
no, I could say the way sometimes it looks, the way it looks sometimes.
Well, I'm saying, let's just take a simple case. You're standing outside and you come in from the rain. And you say, you know, it's pouring like crazy out there. Okay. Now, if we're going to say you made a mistake, well, then we cannot trust your sense perceptions. I mean, that's what you're saying. Your sense perceptions are subject to total error. Well, if that's the case, I can't really exist because I want to walk across the street. Is that a truck? I don't know. I might think it's a truck. It's nothing. Or I might look and I don't see a truck and there's a truck there. You know what I mean? So we can't go based on that type of possibility. If we assume that kind of possibility, then again, we have to be consistent. So if you'll say a person will make a mistake with a simple fact in a clearly observed thing, and for no reason the man made a mistake, well then we can't rely on our senses. Yeah, but if we're going to rely on our senses, then we have to be able to take your statement and say, I know 100% absolutely that it's raining outside, and there's no doubt in my mind.
Why can't he make a mistake in an instance where he's regularly qualified? Like, you know, the majority of people know how to add three-digit numbers, but you could still make a careless mistake or something like that. So you could say, okay, is it in the scope of his knowledge to do a math example like that? Of course, it's in the scope of his knowledge, but he could still make a mistake in a particular instance.
That's right. So then you'd have to say that that operation, you see, is on the fringe of his expertise. You'd have to say that it's close, it's not well within his expertise. In other words, it's in his expertise if he focuses. Then you'd have to requalify what his expertise is. In other words, if a man makes a mistake and wants 1 plus 1, and he thinks it's 8, you're not going to say, well, you know, you made a mistake. That is something that does not require special focus. If a man makes that kind of mistake, you're not going to rely on him for anything, for any kind of calculation. You see? So, but there could be certain calculations that require tremendous focus. And yes, if a man focuses, he won't make any mistakes. But if he doesn't focus, he's going to make a mistake. So then it means that it's well within his expertise under certain conditions. You see? It's like your example. A person can tell if it's raining outside, but if he's standing inside and the windows are cloudy, and he hasn't cleaned the windows for 3 years, and they're smoky, and you hardly see out the window, yeah, then you can't really rely on your senses in that situation. You see? But that's because of the situation. So we have to be talking about something that clearly is within his capacity, and there's nothing preventing it. If there's something preventing him from functioning, so then again, of course, we can't expect good results.
So though you need to take into account the conditions in addition to whether he has the particular expertise?
Exactly. In other words, if there are conditions, let's say, for instance, the man has been up for 4 days, and now you ask him to add, yes, he may make a mistake in 1 plus 1. The man's been up for 4 days, he doesn't know what he's doing. You see? So you can, of course, we're saying under the circumstances that he's in full capacity of his faculties and the situations allow him to use his faculties. If the man, if this is an extenuating situation where the man can't think straight, I mean, then you can't say, well, you see that a person, it's within his expertise and he can't do it. I don't think that would be a fair rebuttal. Okay? So we're talking about a clear case where it's within his expertise, and then we cannot say that he doesn't know it. Then you'd be tantamount to saying, well, we can't know anything. And then you're back to that argument. Okay? Okay, so that's why it's very important. That's why I prefaced with the idea that we're talking about practical knowledge, not theoretical knowledge. Because most of the arguments that a person will hit you with will be crossing over from theoretical to practical. You see? So that's what you have to keep in mind, that the proof of Sinai is a proof from practical logic. And if we may not theoretically know why it is, just like we don't theoretically know that our eyes are telling us the truth. You see? But we're not discussing that kind of knowledge. We're discussing practical knowledge.
Are we saying that practical knowledge is more powerful than theoretical knowledge?
We're saying that practical knowledge is knowledge a person cannot exist 1 second without. Now, is that knowledge true? We don't know. We don't really know. Do I know that you exist? How can I prove it? It's an assumption that if I don't make, I can't exist. You see, that's the limitation of a human being. If we were not human, if we were divine, then we wouldn't have these problems. But a human being is limited by his faculties. Okay? So the only knowledge that I have of the world is through my senses. If the senses are wrong, well then, I'm living in a dream. Okay? But the point is, we have to live. So if we have to live, it's nice to be a philosopher. You can be a philosopher all you want. But do you want to exist? Yes. Now, how do you exist? You exist based on these premises. So we are just saying, be consistent. If you accept your senses, don't start telling me now, well, how do we know? Okay? If you want to maintain that position, then be consistent. Then just the rest of your life, don't accept anything.
Your kind of practical knowledge is just knowledge that a person acts based on? Is that...
Knowledge, yeah, that a person needs to exist. I mean, I look out and I see a room. Is that theoretical knowledge? No. It's practical knowledge. Okay, it's knowledge that if I don't conform to that knowledge, I don't really have too much of a chance to exist. Okay? It's not a question of whether the room is here. You can ask all day from today to tomorrow. But can we live like that? No. The only way we can live is if we assume the room is here. So I say those premises that we assume as part of our practical knowledge, that is what we are using when it comes to the proof of our Sinai. And we have to stick to those premises. As long as we stick to those premises, we're being consistent. Okay? Good.
We said that it was the general nature of mankind to tell the truth.
Yes.
Is it necessarily the general practice of mankind to be consistent? I mean, are people usually consistent in their lives, or are most people totally changing their minds about things every day?
That's correct. That's right. People are not consistent. But the question is, should we follow that practice, or should we aim to be consistent? Many people are irrational. They do crazy things. They're inconsistent when their emotions, when they want something, all of a sudden, yeah, how do I know? I don't know anything exists. You see? Yeah, people are inconsistent. But that is not the correct way to act. That's not the way that we should conduct ourselves with inconsistency. When it comes to one area, we say we accept the senses, and then when we don't like it, well, we reject the senses. How can we, if we want to function like that, well, there's no sense having a discussion. What's the purpose of having a discussion? If the premises get changed when the conclusions that a person wants are at risk, there's no sense in discussing anything. You just go about your merry way. Okay? If you want to have a discussion and try to arrive at some kind of knowledge, you're presupposing consistency. That we're going to have a consistent set of premises. Okay, otherwise, there's no purpose in having a discussion. You have your premises, I have mine, and that's it. Yes?
What's the nature of the relationship between the theoretical knowledge and the practical knowledge? Can one influence the other? Like, it seems like in the cases that we're talking about, then, there are cases where either the theoretical knowledge is in line with the practical knowledge, or theoretical knowledge is uncertain, but practically you have to act one way. But if the theoretical knowledge would disprove the existence of something,
right,
then wouldn't that affect the practical knowledge?
I don't know.
I'm thinking of a case if there's certain scientific facts which come from our theoretical knowledge. So, but practically, then the knowledge that a person would come to without the theoretical knowledge, practically,
right,
a person would act in a different way. So, once theoretical knowledge comes to a certain truth, then that influences the practical knowledge, right?
Okay.
So, a person can act either based on practical knowledge or based on theoretical knowledge, right?
Yes. Because it can go against this practical knowledge. Practical knowledge, by definition, means knowledge without which I cannot exist. Now, a person can't go against that because, by definition, he can't exist. In other words, practical knowledge means that I accept my senses. Why do I accept my senses? Because if I deny my senses, I can't exist for a second. How am I going to go anywhere? How am I going to walk? How am I going to know where to go? Okay? So, by definition, practical knowledge means knowledge that without which I cannot exist. That's what practical knowledge means. Now, if you're telling me, could a guy go against his practical knowledge? That's impossible. By definition. Because he wouldn't exist. Yeah.
Well, maybe any time that theoretical knowledge is in line with practical knowledge, you can go by theoretical, but then it would be in line with practical.
And it's practical.
The practical,
yeah, then
practical is just knowledge that I don't accept because I have any particular basis for it. I accept because that's the only way I can exist. Okay? Why does a person believe his eyes? Because he worked out a theory that the eyes are true? No. Because if you don't accept your eyes, you can't move. You can't do it. So that premise is based just on practicality. I can't exist. So you're asking me, could a person deny practical knowledge? It's impossible. He could, but then he would die the next second. He'd walk across the street and get hit by a car. So he could do it for a few seconds, but that's about it. Okay?
Can I just try to clarify my question? Let's say a salesman comes along and says to you, I have a product that if you drink this thing, then if you flap your arms, you'll be able to fly, right? So, you happen to be a biologist, and you understand that chemically it's impossible. So normally a person might accept accept what this person says just based on how he normally deals with accepting whether people are telling the truth or lying. But here, because he has a certain theoretical knowledge, which is certain, that he can.
I think I have to take this question after, because I can't. It's just I'm not really focused on that. But I'll be happy to speak now. Take a question after. Okay. Okay. So where are we up to? Right? So now we have a formula. Right? So we say, any knowledge that I myself, let's just review for a second, any knowledge that I myself do not observe is something somebody else observed. Okay? That is secondhand knowledge. And now, the question is, secondhand knowledge, what is the formula that I use to decide when I accept secondhand knowledge and when I reject it? So the formula that we've arrived at is based on the causes of falsehood. There are only two causes of falsehood in secondhand knowledge. One cause is a lie, the other cause is ignorance. Okay? We have a formula where we can eliminate both causes. The first part of the formula is anything that is testified to by a mass of people. any fact that is testified to by a mass of people, we can exclude a lie. The second element is that any fact which is within the range of the intelligence of the person, we can exclude the idea, the possibility of ignorance. Okay? So it comes out, the result is that if I have an event which conforms to those two factors, I have a formula which will absolutely, positively tell me that fact must be true. Okay? Now let's just take a look. Okay? Let's take a look at what the Torah says and see. We'll have a perfect example of a situation like this where we can apply the formula so that we can have some kind of familiarity with what we're doing. Okay? Now if you take a look at the Torah, okay? It's in Dvarim Dalet Tes. It's Pasuk Tes, Dvarim Dalet. Okay? The Pasuk says like this, Rak Hisham Elecha. Okay? Only be careful to yourself, Ushmor Nafshecha Me'od, and watch your soul exceedingly. Pen Tishkaf Es HaDvarim, lest you forget these words, Asher, or these things, Asher Ro'u Einecha, which your eyes have seen, Ufen Yasuru Milvavcha, lest your heart forget. Kol Yimei Chayecha, all the days of your life. Okay? Now listen to the end of the Pasuk says, V'hodatam L'vanecha V'livnei Vanecha, so that you may teach your sons and your grandsons. Okay? Now what is it telling you when it says, so that you may teach your sons and your grandsons? It is telling you, who are the sons and the grandsons? The sons and the grandsons are the ones that were not present at the event. So you have an event where you have two groups of people. You have those that were present, those that have first-hand knowledge, and those that were not present, those with second-hand knowledge. Okay? So the Torah tells you clearly that this event is intended to convince, to be a demonstration to both groups, to those that were there and those that were not there. Okay? So clearly, if this is the case, then this event must conform to our formula of secondhand knowledge. Because if the event was only meant as a demonstration for those that were there, well then, they saw it themselves. There'd be no need for any kind of a special, it wouldn't have to conform to any formula because you saw it yourself. But since the event, clearly the Torah says that the event is designed as a demonstration for those that were not there, the only way that can be true is if the event conforms to this formula of knowledge. Okay? So let's take a look and see. Okay? Next pasuk says, Yom asher amarta lifnei Hashem elokecha b'chorev. You should teach them what? The day that you stood before God at Chorev, which is Sinai. Be'emor Hashem eloi, when God said to me, and what is the first thing he says? Hakel li es ha'am. Gather the people. So the first element of our formula, the pasuk goes right away. Hakel li es ha'am, gather the people. In other words, produce a situation of mass witness. Get numbers. Okay? We must have this event must be done in front of numbers. Okay? Why in front of numbers? For one reason, to exclude the possibility of a lie. Because God knew that this is the formula that any person living in the future must use in order to verify if an event happened. He must be able to exclude the possibility of a lie. And the only way to exclude the possibility of a lie is numbers. So that's why the first thing God says to Moshe, gather the people. This must be done in front of the mass. Okay? A mass of people, the entire nation. If it's done in front of the entire nation, then you can never have a claim of fabrication. Because that would mean mass conspiracy. And that we can't accept. That's an impossibility. Okay? So that's the first element. Then what is the next thing? The pasuk says, V'ashmiim es devarai. I will let them hear my words. Asher yomadum liyiraosi kol hayamim asherim chayim al ha'adama, that you will learn to fear all the days of your life. Okay. Now listen closely. It says, Vatikravun Vatarmadun Tachasahar, you drew near and you stood under the mountain. Viahar Boer Baesh, and the mountain was consumed by fire. Okay? Simple event. There was a fire, the mountain was consumed by fire ad lev hashamayim. That is an event that any person, the simplest person, can accurately determine. Because a fire is an observation that's within the range of the intelligence of every person. A person sees a fire, he knows what it is. That's a fire. Okay? We do not need an advanced expert to make that observation. What's the next part of the pasuk? It says, Ve'har bar ba'esh ad lev hashamayim, choshech, darkness, Anan, clouds via Rafael, and thick darkness. Simple observation. There was darkness. Any person that is of average intelligence is able to determine it's dark outside. That is not an advanced observation. Okay? You go to the next pasuk. Vayidabar Hashem Aleichem mitoch ha'esh. God spoke to you from the fire. Kol dvarim atem shomim. The voice of words you heard. That is a simple observation, a simple event. We heard a voice of words. We heard a voice coming from the fire. A voice any person can observe. That does not require any kind of knowledge. Okay? It's a simple observation that's within the realm, within the range of the intelligence of the observer. So you see from the event, the demonstration of Sinai was designed to fulfill both elements of the formula. Number one, it was done in front of the masses, so you have number. And number two, the event was a simple, observable event. Okay? So therefore we say that a person that studies this, a person that sees this, must accept this event with the same certitude. It conforms to our formula. So a person, if he will be consistent, must accept this event with the same certitude that he accepts that when he walks into the doctor's office, that man is a physician. Okay? Because it conforms to both elements. It was done in front of the entire nation, and the events were simplistic events. Any man can know that there's a voice coming from heaven. It is not a complex event. Yeah?
It sounds pretty complex.
Sounds complex?
I mean, I get it, you hear a voice, but tell me that it's God's voice? I mean, that's...
Well, you hear a voice.
If 100 people came here and said, I heard God's voice, you'd be like... Yeah.
Well, God created a voice. It's
one second.
Voice.
One second. Are you saying a voice...
You can hear a voice.
You can hear a voice. Well, that's what the Torah says. That everybody heard a voice. Okay? Everybody standing there heard a voice. Okay? And they saw the fire. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. So that event is one... That a person will have every component that he needs for secondhand knowledge. Okay? So if a person, right? Okay, any questions?
Well, the question, how do you react to that? Because on the one hand, I wouldn't believe them because there's a lot of people, but on the other hand, the dad explained to me why God spoke to them if we were already spoken to.
Okay, well, one second. you see, we're trying to prove that the event that was depicted in the Torah happened. You see? That's what we're trying to prove. Now, we're saying that if the event didn't happen, it would have to be for one of two reasons. Either you have a mass multitude of people that are lying, they made it up, it's a fabrication, okay? Or they were too ignorant to recognize what was going on, okay? Now, I don't think you can show me that either of those possibilities could occur. Okay? Because we don't accept that a whole nation makes up fabricated stories, in which case it's not a fabrication. Okay? And unless you can show me that hearing a voice is something too complex for the average person to experience, I don't see how they could be ignorant, how they could make a mistake. So in the absence of those two possibilities, wouldn't we have to... we have to say that the event occurred exactly the way the Torah just described it? Would there be any other possibility? Right? So that's what we're trying to show.
Question?
Yeah.
So at this point, then, the event that we're trying to verify is a burning mountain, clouds, darkness, and a voice of words.
Yes.
And that's it. We're not trying to verify any of the implications of any of that.
No, that's not the verifications are something you draw yourself. We are trying to show, you see, we are trying to show that you are not at any disadvantage the fact that you're not there. In other words, you have the same knowledge as if you were standing right there and you witnessed those events. Exactly the events that are written in the Torah. Your knowledge of those events is equal as if you were standing right there and watching everything happen. You see, you have the same exact knowledge, same certitude, as if you were a man standing right there watching everything that was occurring. You saw the mountain on fire, and you heard the voice. You see, what conclusions you draw, that's up to you. Okay, if you would tell me that if I was standing there, I'd walk away and say, "Well, I don't know what that is." Okay, so then you could do the same thing now. But all we are saying is that you have the same knowledge as if you were standing there. You see, so whatever conclusion you would draw from that, you have the same exact knowledge that they have. Same exact perception that they had, you have the same exact knowledge.
Are we missing the very important fact of what the nature of the voice was? Like whether it was, whether it sounded like it was from a man or whether it sounded like it wasn't from a man?
It says Vaydavar Hashem Aleichem mitoch ha'esh, God spoke to you from the fire, called dvar matem shomem, a voice you heard, utemuna einichem roen, but you didn't hear, but you didn't see any figure. Okay, then it says like this. It says further. It says like this. It says, then in Devarim Dalet Pasuk. Let me just see here 1 second. Yeah, Pasuk Lamed Beis. Okay, Kisha'ana Liyamim Rishonim. Ask about the days of old. Asher Hayu Lefanecha, which existed before. Lemin Hayom Asher Bara Elokim, from the day that God created Adam al ha'aretz, man on the earth, ule miktzei ha'shamayim v'ad kitzei ha'shamayim, from one end of the heaven to the other. In other words, inquire in the whole history of man and in the entire globe. Kadavar ha'gadol hazeh, has there ever been a great thing like this? O hanishma kamahu, where has anything been heard like this? Okay, ha'shama am, has a nation heard? Kol Hashem, the voice of God, medaber, speaking, mitoch ha'esh, from the fire. A voice where an observer hears coming from that source. Okay, the fire. Ka'asher shamata ata v'yechi. Like you heard and are alive this day. Has this ever happened? Okay, so the Torah is depicting exactly what they experienced. They were standing there, they saw the mountain on fire, the darkness, and they heard a voice coming from the fire. That was the observation. Okay? Pretty simplistic observation, and that's what they experienced. Now, based on our knowledge, we know 100% that that event occurred. You see? Now, if you'll tell me, now we can ask, why is that a good demonstration? In other words, assuming I was there, should I be convinced? Okay, separate question. Separate question, and we can take that question up. But I want to just, in this session, I want to just establish that fact before we get into what are the implications, what should I do about this, what does this mean? A lot of good questions, okay? But first we have to establish that it happened before we can ask what we should do about it, okay? So I think that point has to be something clear. If you have a question about that point, did this happen? I'll be happy to take that. Further questions, we can continue next week. I have no problem. Yeah.
If a million people came to me and said that happened, then I would have to believe with the same certitude. But we're reading what the account was from the Torah. So mean, how do we know
Very good question. So what you're saying is, we're reading it in a book. Maybe one guy made it up, and there were no million people there. One guy decided, I'm going to write a book. I know the formula, so I'll put in this book that there's a million people there, and I'll make up whatever I want. Right? Very nice. So I'll ask you, could anybody do that? In other words, could I right now come and write a book and say, well, there are a million people there. God revealed himself at the White House 200, 300 years ago. Make up a new history. Can you do that? Can any man do that? You can't do that because you can't make up a new history. You can say that there was one man in the White House, in some room in the White House, who heard God talking 300 years ago. You could say there was a man in the White House, in one room of the White House, a particular man who heard God talking 2 days ago. You could say anything you want if it's one man. You see? But you can't say that the whole nation, this nation, we have the book, we're the Jews, we're the descendants of this nation. You can't come to that nation with a book saying, hey, guys, here's your history. Here's what you witnessed 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 800 years ago. Well, the people that are in the nation are obviously going to ask one question. Well, it's very nice. How come we never heard about this? How come this is the first we're hearing about this? That you're going to have a hard time explaining that. And if that's something you could explain, well, then why can't a man now come right now and say, well, George Washington never exists. We've got a new history.
Yeah. Okay. At the time of Sinai, I would definitely agree that there's no way that these events happened any other way by hand. They were too amazing. You can't replicate those things. Today, though, I feel like...
First of all, just to stop you for 1 second, you're asking further the further question. In other words, we are trying to establish that the events occur. Now, what the implications of the events are, you see, whether, well, maybe nowadays we have enough technology, well, we would... Okay, that we have to go into. I agree. But this session, what I want to establish is merely that we have knowledge that these events occurred. What they mean, separate point. You know what I'm saying? Okay. So I just want to stick to that, and I'm happy to go further next week. Okay? Because what happens is, you see, if we don't stick to that, we can get off sidetracked on what they mean, and then we could talk about that all day, and then people walk away and say, 1 second, what did this happen or not? So we first have to establish the facts. Then we can go into that. Okay. But if you have any further questions about... Yeah.
Are you saying that the reason why we know what happened at Sinai is because it wouldn't have been passed down from generation to generation to us?
That's right.
Because they would have said, no, this never happened.
This never happened. Right. Why didn't we have this history? Okay. How can a person come along somewhere mid-history and say, here's a new history? You could do that if you're not giving it to the guys that... By the people. You can go across the world and give somebody else a history about somebody, about China that they don't know from Adam. Yeah. You can't go to the Chinese and write the new Chinese history and give it to them. They'll laugh in your face. Yeah.
So what about certain societies that, let's say, they have mythology that their people are the descendants of gods or similar things like that? They talk about all kinds of fantastical events that they assert is part of their history. So what would you say is the difference when you're talking about Torah Messina, when you're talking about those kind of cultures?
What do you mean? What do you mean, those kind of cultures? You mean like, religions based on mass revelation?
No, like they believe that their forefathers descended from gods, their children,
okay,
and they have all these...
Okay,
like,
anything you want. I mean, Muhammad said that God spoke to him in a cave. I mean, Jesus claimed, you know, the New Testament claims that Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, you can make any claim you want. You see,
right.
But nobody claims that these happened in front of the whole nation. Nobody makes that claim. Right, if you look in the New Testament, for instance, in Matthew, I mean, I forgot to bring it in, but in Matthew, where it claims that Jesus rose from the dead, okay? Now, they don't even claim that the entire nation witnessed this. And not only that, but at the end of the paragraph, they say that what happened was Jesus rose from the dead, but the Jews wanted to dispel this belief. So they bribed the guards that were at the tomb to say that, no, somebody came and took him away, you know, to lie. Even though they say, no, that the angel came down from heaven and took his body, but the Jews came and bribed the guards to say that, no, his disciples came and took him away, okay? And it says, and the Jews believe this to that very day. The Jews make this false claim to this very day. That's what it says in Matthew. Now I ask you. I mean, you're telling me that this great miracle happened, and yet in the very book, I mean, I don't know how intelligent the person could be, but in the very book, the person claims that those people that lived in that time didn't accept it. Those people that were living in that land, the Jews, they rejected these miracles. Now, how convincing could you be if you're writing a book to show that miracles happen, okay, and the only people that accept those miracles are the people that aren't living there, that were not actual witnesses, people that live in a different land. But the actual witnesses, if you're going to write in your book, the people that were actually there and witnessed these miracles, they don't accept it. Well, that doesn't seem too convincing. You're telling me that the people that were actually supposedly there when these things were done, they reject that these things happened? Well, then how could we possibly have any kind of validity? Okay, if the person that was writing this was intelligent, he would make the claim that, of course, all the Jews accepted Jesus. You see, but why couldn't he make that claim? Because you can't make a claim that's false. You can't, because clearly none of the Jews accepted him. So they could never make that claim.
So you're saying that the Torah is different because
Torah is making the claim that God spoke to the Jews in front of the entire nation. That was witnessed by an entire nation. There is no religion anywhere that makes that claim. There is no religion. Christianity, Muslim, nobody makes that claim. That is why, if you'll notice, every religion, every modern religion, well, the three, the Judaism and Christianity and Muslim, they say those are the three major religions. So if you'll notice, every other religion, Christianity and Muslim, relies on our Old Testament. They accept our Old Testament. Right? In other words, the Christians have the New Testament. But the New Testament, they add, they don't throw away the Old Testament. Right? The Old Testament, they still accept. Why is that? Because you can't start a new religion. You can't just come along and make up a new religion. Our religion is based on something real. We have mass revelation. You can't come along and claim a mass revelation if it didn't happen. It's an impossibility, because who's going to believe it? The people that it didn't happen to certainly aren't going to believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that the other religions don't claim mass conspiracy, I mean, it's kind of precious. Right. Wouldn't that be a That's much right. better...
That would be a much better claim.
Yeah,
that's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Like Muhammad says that God spoke to him in a cave. Well, wouldn't it be a greater claim if Muhammad said God spoke to me in front of everybody? That would certainly, if he could make a claim like that, he certainly would make a claim like that. He wouldn't say this happened in private, right? Well, why doesn't he say that? Well, obviously, because he can't say that. Because people know that it didn't happen. See, you cannot make a claim of mass revelation if it didn't happen. Because the people that you're talking to know it didn't happen. All right? That's enough. All right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe we could, if you want, next week, I know they have me slated for next week, so if you want, next week we could take up further questions. We could, you know, or if you have questions you think of in the meantime, we could take that up. Okay? So let's just, I guess we can use the week just to let this settle in, and then... perhaps there's further questions. Okay? All right.